The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Michael Brooks is a co-host of The Majority Report and the host of The Michael Brooks Show, and this week he's returning to the Zero Books podcast to discuss a debate between Sam Harris and Ezra Klein. The debate about racism, identity politics, intellectual honesty, and the controversy over Harris's podcast with Charles Murray was released as episode 123 of the Waking Up podcast. Brooks and I discuss both who won and what epistemological problem was at the center of the debate. It's Wednesday, May 16th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Turning to Zero Books, I should point out that Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies is absolutely still a book worth reading, and that she is planning to return to the Zero Books podcast to discuss the ideas of Christopher Lash sometime in June. If you haven't read Kill All Normies, now is the time. Pick it up from an online store, at your local bookstore, or at your local library. Also, the newest Zero Books YouTube video is entitled The Intellectual Dark Web is Afraid of Marx. If you like this podcast, you should check out the Zero Books YouTube channel. Finally, if you aren't supporting this podcast through the Inside Zero Books Patreon page, you're missing out on a second podcast every week. I'd urge you to go ahead and take the plunge. The music you're listening to right now is the theme song from Sam Harris's Waking Up podcast. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Brooks and I discuss epistemology, Sam Harris, race, and nerds.
I went to the University of Oregon to visit my two older kids, and I took Amtrak to go to Eugene. And so I had some time, and I listened to the Sam Harris podcast, specifically the podcast with Ezra Klein from Vox. Mm-hmm. And I found it to be very interesting. So interesting that I listened to it on the way back as well. I felt like it was a worthwhile thing to think about, but not on the level of like figuring out who I agreed with in that conversation, but to figure out what it was like altogether, what that thing was, and what were the core issues of that conversation. But before I go into what I thought of it and we get deep into this subject, I just want to give you a chance to make fun of Sam Harris.
I always appreciate the opportunity to put Sam Harris in context. Several years ago, basically when I first started in this business, basically like 2013, 2014, and I started subbing on the Majority Report, I did some segments on Sam Harris because, I think a lot about the Middle East and I've spent time there and I'm, pretty oriented in that way. His writings on that region and on Islam in particular were just basically egregiously stupid. I mean, kind of some combination of sort of positivism, historical literacy, and no understanding about the dynamics of the region, how it works, and the broader issue. And I want to just say, usually when you say that, the first response of his sort of cult and fans is, oh, well, you're one of those people who thinks that the only variable is, U.S. imperialism or Western abuses. And I would, to which I say, yeah, those things are actually extremely significant in how, the reality of that region and any analysis that doesn't account for those things, and Sam's analysis obviously doesn't, isn't a full analysis. But even beyond that, when I bring up those factors, I'm talking like in a very value neutral way. one of the reasons that there's such a perception of Islam in the world as there is today is because of the disproportionate power of Saudi Arabia. So, like, if and of course there's a U.S. and an oil dimension to that as well. But I mean, just even I'll do a thought experiment, which I know those people love. If a Sufi tribe had taken over Mecca and Medina and had oil, right, discovered there as it was and struck that agreement with FDR, and it might still be, you know, an autocratic country, it might still be more socially conservative, it might still be a monarchy. But if they were Sufis and they had that amount of largesse where they were literally funding, you know, mosques and training centers and sort of propagandizing a particular version of Islam everywhere from, you know, Pakistan to Indonesia to Senegal to the United States, and that version was Sufism, the global perception of what Islam is would be radically different. And that's just a, you know, purely material basis. So when I say that, it's not just that I'm saying you're not, you know, acknowledging the big bad dictator backing the United States, which he isn't, but you're also just not looking at how politics works. So and how these things actually function in the world. And, you know, and I got a lot of blowback, and that's when I first encountered his cult. And it also always struck me, and I've only recently been able to kind of put my finger on it more clearly as I think I've in some ways sort of hopefully deepened in some ways as an analyst myself, and specifically with now Sam Harris getting into the quote unquote, the race quote unquote science game, is that, well, just two more things. I mean, one, that I think he really, in that line where he sort of in his, you know, the historical facts are irrelevant, and he had his little sort of, you know, kind of tantrum moment with Ezra, I actually think he's really showing the store. And I think he's actually really revealing why anybody who, I mean, and this is really is an anybody moment from a, you know, a sort of, you know, Washington, D.C. liberal, you know, centrist like Ezra Klein, through obviously people who, you know, are very anchored and focusing on, you know, identity and various forms of domination and discrimination in that area. But I would also even argue that for people like us, who obviously, I mean, I certainly take identity and you take identity into account, but are also trying to inject a broader material awareness and a broader historical awareness. Sam Harris's project is basically a war on any form of human knowing that isn't a incredibly narrow, you know, either ideation or a stat. I mean, it's a kind of thought process where, you know, you could, I guess you could understand Hamlet by looking at the, you know, material properties of like the pages that it's printed on, but I don't think that would get you an actual understanding of Hamlet. And I don't know if that makes sense, but I think the implications of this are really, really deep, especially as it comes to everything from, you know, understanding how global affairs works to this new reassertion of, you know, a stat like IQ, which we could critique on and should critique and interrogate on any number of levels. But it's not just that Sam Harris and of his ilk, it's not just that they're trying to, quote unquote, defend objectivity. They're saying any form of human sort of investigation that isn't in that extraordinarily narrow lane is illegitimate or, you know, subjective or whatever. And basically the entire discipline of history by extension. So I think that that's pretty notable.
Well, okay. So this is a good point to jump in because this question of like, it's a question of epistemology. You know, how do we know the world and what's the legitimate way to know the world?
Right.
Is definitely at the center of the conversation between Harris and Klein.
Yep.
And I have a real kind of mixed reaction to the conversation on that level specifically. Like, I'm actually not sure where I stand. Harris was upset because he thinks that you can have reference to some sort of scientific consensus on something as politically freighted as IQ and genetic ancestry in a way that is objective. You know, that you have recourse to objective facts. Klein, on the other hand, argued that this whole realm of IQ research around race was already kind of overdetermined by politics and social facts, and that the biases are in that arena would be so rampant that there's no way to have any access to an objective scientific consensus, that we ought to be very wary of claiming that we've reached a conclusion, and that in fact that we shouldn't claim that we've reached a conclusion, because the history of this kind of research shows that whenever people think they've reached a conclusion on this, it's discovered later that they were mostly creating pseudoscience, and you know, they were heavily politically and racially motivated, and years later we look back and laugh at the conclusions they drew, and also you know, sort of scoff at their moral character. And then, of course, this made Harris just apoplectic, right?
Yeah, that was the very funny. I love this sort of controlled, and it's also funny stylistically, because Ezra Klein is what, you know, Harris brands himself as. But the thing with it's like underneath the whole Calm Act, it's like warning, contents under pressure. I mean, I think, you know, like Sam Harris's sort of unbelievable egomania and inability, I think this sort of ego identity of never being wrong, like, hey, if I need to promote racism, that's fine. That's secondary to never admitting a mistake, which is really striking as a public persona.
Yeah, that's the thing that really, just about Harris, that really rang through on that. Was that there was no humility on his side at all.
Oh, no. Of course not.
And that he didn't, I think he would have gone a long way to, if he had just said, I understand that my own perception of this situation might be colored in a number of ways that I'm not even aware of. However, I do want to hold on to this notion of that there being a scientific consensus. And from where I'm sitting, that's what I see. Tell me, you know, where I've gone wrong. But it's still a problem. Just there's this epistemological problem at the root of this, which is, do we have any access to scientific facts that aren't colored by politics and social reality and history and all of that? I don't think we do.
I actually would go in the opposite direction, where I would almost even be really interested in interrogating areas that seem totally non-controversial. Like, well, wait, why are certain populations disproportionately susceptible to certain diseases? Like, those things are not, you know, innately controversial, emotionally triggering, you know, subject areas. But I would still be err on the side of, and I think it's important to make a distinction before I make my point. Yeah. Nobody's actually debating, like, there are these tests, and across populations, certain populations score higher than others. Like, Asians score higher than whites, whites score higher than Hispanic and Black people, right? Like, that's actually the part that is, that's the closest to a sky is blue statement of the whole conversation. And there's no argument about that.
Right.
The arguments are, you know, and the argument I would want to have, getting back to my point, is what are these tests to begin with, and what are they actually measuring? And okay, I'm not a geneticist, but I mean, I find it extremely hard to believe, both from my own actually, you know, reading of science as best I can, which I think all of us have to admit, you know, unless we're specialists, that's what we're doing. But I think, like, you know, the way Sam tried to frame the initial critique in Vox from people like Eric Turkheimer, who I'm going to have on my show soon, was, you know, highly misleading. I mean, these are people who are totally, you know, they're the ones who are in the data sets of this world. And and in fact, it's not even that they're saying, like, a guy like Turkheimer is not saying that it's purely environmental and socially constructed, but he's almost more saying that it's like so environmentally mediated that it's hard to disaggregate. And also, and this makes a lot of sense to me on a policy and historical lens, that like, and he actually also splits it up a lot with class versus race, which I think is interesting because these things also track with class dimension. And he was like, you know, basically like, you know, rich kids, it's mostly quote unquote genetic. Poor kids, it's mostly quote unquote environmental. And also that this isn't a static statistic. It's almost like more going to the doctor and seeing how your health is. It doesn't mean that your physical can't change in 6 months or so, right?
Right.
And then I think more broadly though, I'm still of the position that yes, maybe this test has grown in sophistication. Maybe this, you know, there are certain things which we could say are less culturally mediated, like, you know, reaction time to flashing lights or something. But at the end of the day, the history of what this test is and how it has been deployed politically and historically, and even just the fact, frankly, that these are proprietary tests for a private industry that exerts an enormous amount of power in the world and has a market on quantifying this thing we call intelligence. I mean, that to me is such a, you know, obvious and robust area for discussion and critique. So I think, yes, I agree with you. I think the idea that you can have 2 + 2, you know, equals 4 conversations in the context of this type of science, I just don't buy.
Nietzsche's supposed to hold the scandalous view that knowledge is a form of power. Now that's scandalous because knowledge is knowledge. It's objective, you know, like journalism. And it would be scandalous to show that wherever we find knowledge, we will find it structured and constructed around a system or systems of power. Won't find one without the other. Now, one can think of this along the simplest pedagogical models. By that, I mean the classroom models. I mean, I ought to know this from teaching the university. I know how to pass along knowledge. To get someone to believe me in the last analysis, I give them an A, which I could replace with a happy face. They're used to that. That's from kindergarten. They're both just symbols, right, of achievement. They're not getting paid for this stuff, right? You just give them a little A, they smile. That same system starts in kindergarten, happy face, A, runs through there. F, no face, blank. Same thing would work in kindergarten. That form I use looks fair. I mean, I'm grading objectively. But the point is deeper, that what the knowledge is based on is my spot of power as the teacher. That's what it's based on. Now, you would go, oh no, it's based on what's really true. Yeah, but how does that get meted and how does that get meted out and parsed out? Who decides that? Well, the blunt and ugly answer is we do, the teachers do, we decide. Now you're going to, there are clear counterexamples to Nietzsche's argument. In mathematics, at its simplest levels, I will grant you that if we're doing a mathematics course, I could grade objectively. But I will also grant you that nothing of great importance to human values hangs on truths that everyone can accept. That 2 + 2 = 4, that A is A, are all acceptable. And they're acceptable precisely because nothing of very great human importance hangs on them. The moment you go a little beyond that in any direction, even in math class, when you discuss, for example, the philosophy of mathematics, then the disputes start, and then power at some point has to insert itself and decide.
I think what Harris would say, and I think a lot of people who would support this would say, look, the tests that they did, and you made reference to it, so the tests that they've done to try to come to these conclusions that came to these conclusions took into account the way that, say, material conditions might affect IQ. That they tried to, like, set up their tests to account for those variations and see what would be strictly genetic. You know, they had ways of determining that.
Doesn't that strike you as just like impossible? I mean, and this is, and I mean that in a very like, oh God, I wish I could remember.
Well, I think it's always, you have to question what they did, right? I mean, that's the thing. Like, you'd have to get down to.
Well, I know that people like Charles Murray, and Charles Murray being the person that, it's so funny. I mean, he's such a menace and despicable figure in my estimation, but he's much more in his, I mean, he's also kind of mastered being disingenuous, but he's a lot more at least open about his, you know, his extremist politics. But his basic perspective is that, you know, when segregation became, you know, sort of not on the books anymore, and then after a couple of years of things like Head Start, you know, that's your environmental factor.
Right. I mean, and that's
that's ridiculous. And I could even tell you, speaking anecdotally as a white guy, you know, not even having the added, you know, and it's funny because I'm in some of these kind of intramural left conversations, I'm in the position of sort of, you know, holding a Marxist line against an intersectional view. But in the broader world, there's no doubt that being a straight white man is certainly easier. That's just the reality. But I grew up with a tremendous amount of material and money insecurity and, you know, sometimes even food insecurity and home insecurity. And the notion that that didn't, like, you know, affect my ability to, you know, to think clearly, perform well at certain times is insane. And just as conversely, on the other hand, the fact that in spite of that, you know, I was having this horrible experience in the context of being in nice, leafy college towns where I could, you know, read books at the library and, you know, consume all sorts of information and go to talks at local colleges. And there was all this social capital I could tap into. I think the notion that you could separate those things is just delusional. And not only is it delusional, I think it's actually a basic marquee divide. I think that actually is an area where we could safely say there is some version of quote unquote left that encapsulates everybody from Ezra Klein to Chomsky. And then on the other hand, there's a right, which is Sullivan to Peterson, which is that this stuff is just, whether it's religious or scientific, it just is what it is and deal with it. And I just don't buy it, period.
Right. Well, I agree with you in principle, you know, in the large view, but when it comes to an individual study, they tend to, like, you know, try to segregate out their results based on, say, income or wealth distribution, so they'll only look at IQ scores from neighborhoods with a certain level of wealth or some. I mean, this is my, I'm not actually at all educated about all the different ways that they try to control for those material influences on IQ, but I think that those exist. Now, whether or not they're adequate is a completely different question. But it was one that was never discussed in this conversation between Klein and Harris. And that is of interest to me. And because what they were arguing about was not actually the results of the studies, because neither one of them wanted to get into the weeds on that. I don't want to get into the weeds on that myself, not being a scientist and not wanting to bore the audience. But they were arguing about which biases matter. They were arguing about, Harris was saying, the biases influencing that's coloring our perceptions on this issue is political correctness. That's Harris's position. And Klein saying, no, no, no. The bias that's coloring our perception on this is the history of racism. Now, you know, I side with Klein. If we're going to look to which bias I think is going to be more powerful, you know, I think.
Right, of course.
Right.
Yeah, of course.
That said, probably both biases are always at work around this issue. Yeah. So, you know, the real question is, how do we overcome bias? And what does it mean to overcome bias? What is required to do that? And is it even possible?
I think bias is impossible to overcome in the sense that, and I, you know, and I, here's the distinction I would draw. You know, in my work, I think my value set and what I'm trying to make happen in the world is incredibly clear. And I don't even, you know, I don't know if bias really encapsulates that. Like, bias is kind of a, I don't know, bias is sort of a more, like, to me, you know, I don't know, I'd like to see the Sixers do well in the playoffs. Like, that's my bias. I don't know if it's the same as a sort of a moral conviction, but maybe that's getting kind of nitpicky. I am also pretty, you know, and I'm sure I make mistakes, and I'm sure also, again, you know, this is probably where bias colors things, but I don't, you know, I always do my best to present information, you know, honestly, in the context of my argument, right? Like, I'm not going to be using, you know, bad studies or something to kind of sustain my argument. But I do think that this kind of notion of, you know, some platonic realm, I think it's both impossible, and I also think that the people who, you know, and this is where it really gets zeroed in with Harris, people like Harris who are always banging on about, you know, PC culture, it is so just like drippingly obvious that this is a, you know, a major reaction coming out of their own biases that it's almost sort of comical to watch. And let me just say, like, you know what I think an example of this actually is the way this whole argument got dredged up again was, you know, Harris did this, you know, he did his interview with Murray, and then Vox published, you know, three people in the field. And again, like, I think it's sort of mind-blowingly presumptuous of Harris to say, like, oh, these people are, you know, obscure or not in the mainstream or something. That's not even, I mean, you know, it's funny. Like, at the end of the day, Harris is a fucking podcaster. Like, I don't, which is great. Like, I'm a podcaster, right? You know.
Right. But I would hardly feel like, as a podcaster, I can weigh in on who is obscure and who is at the center of.
Yeah, there is like a certain, right. And it's not even just for, like, I don't think we need to even fetishize the hard sciences. It's just sort of like, you know, I'm interested in, you know, in classical Buddhist studies. And it's just like, not me, like, oh, well, this person, you know, that's the real Pali scholar, this other interpretation's bullshit. And I know this, you know, like, it's so presumptuous and egotistical, but at any rate, you know, they published a takedown from three people that, whatever, and of course, and this is where, look, this is where there's just some element of, their argument was totally persuasive to me, because it seemed both, you know, I could follow it in terms of the weeds of that side of the argument, and also, you know, it's a scientific argument that also is dealing with reality. And social and economic structures. And, you know, I just think the idea that you could discuss this stuff without those things not only being considered, but sort of integrated into the every facet of the analysis is, in fact, just, you know, a fool or bigot's errand. So they released this, you know, they released this piece, and then a year or several months later, there's this column that comes out in March by David Reich in the New York Times, who's a geneticist at Harvard. And again, first of all, he made this distinction, and I don't, you know, some people think this is a very important distinction. I'm wary of it, but that first, yes, like, race is a discredited concept, but populations aren't. And it might be, and this was an interesting distinction. He basically said, we might find some stuff that unsettles us about things like cognition. And he made all of these points to say, first of all, you know, none of us live in group averages. So even that, like, you know, on average, people in Denmark are taller than people in the United States, but there's tons of, you know, 6'3" people in the United States. Like, he laid all of these, you know, sort of safety points. And I had problems with the argument, cause I still have my innate skepticism about, you know, is cognition, you know, is it really some innate trait? Is it really as simple as that? Is there really one thing called intelligence? You know, and all the social and political mediation you can never escape. you know, and all, and is population really different than race? I mean, I had a lot of critical things with that piece, but I did not read that piece and think that David Reich was a bigot or, you know, any of that. And what was funny is that there was no, there was a critique and a response that there should be with anything, but there was no, like, nobody came out and said David Reich was the second coming of Charles Murray or anything. In fact, he was taking a lot of pains not to be in that op-ed, even if it was a mistaken piece, right? So that goes, and, you know, and Harris tweets at Klein, like, oh, you know, you should be on the war path. You know, you should, the, where's the PC police on this? And it's kind of funny. It's like, well, if you need to call the police, the PC police, that must mean that they weren't, you know, actually that PC'd out by the piece. And, you know, and then, because, you know, what Harris is saying, and so the irony is that here's actually an example of a piece that, again, someone like me has all sorts of disagreements from what I can gauge, questions and skepticism about things that I don't fully understand, and wariness of how these arguments are deployed in the public. But I don't think that David Reich is a racist. I don't think that that piece is like, you know, not, I would criticize him in nowhere near the same terms that I would criticize Sam Harris or Charles Murray or any of these people. And Harris comes out, and so, like, literally what Harris is freaking out about, which is that why can't there just be this certain type of really, you know, face the truth openness. And there is actually a demonstration of it by David Reich. And not, and by the way, not only was there not a big, you know, meltdown, there was actually a response to David Reich that was signed by, you know, a group of, like, I think 50 biologists, anthropologists, you know, scholars across a variety of disciplines. And they wrote, you know, again, it wasn't polemical, just a response. And the Times chose not to run it, and they had to run it in BuzzFeed. So Sam Harris is like living in a fantasy, like, in the sense that what he's actually calling for was done by David Reich, and David Reich is doing totally fine. And even the people that are critiquing him, I guess, such as myself, are critiquing him, you know, not on the terms that Harris freaks out about.
Fundamentally, what's going on with Harris is he fucked up. And with that interview with Murray, and he's doing everything he can to kind of do damage control to his own ego, is how I look at it.
Yeah, right.
Nonetheless, despite that, I still have these questions about how we all should look at this question about populations and IQ. One thing about the way this question is asked, or the way we debate the question, really doesn't sit right with me. And I think both Klein and Harris seem to believe that our system is set up so that if it weren't for corruption, and if it weren't for all people, and if we had a society where everyone had the same abilities, and we didn't live in a corrupt society with this history of racism or inequality, that we'd get equal outcomes in the world. But that isn't the case, because we live in a class society that, in order to function, has to have access to a class of people whose only option is to go to work for someone else. So we live in a world that requires a large group of people without productive property, and, you know, the people who have to often do boring, repetitive, maybe backbreaking work. We wouldn't find a society where there were equal outcomes, even if everyone had the same abilities and the system wasn't corrupt. The system is set up to create inequalities. You know, once you think about that, then the question of who has the most intelligence sort of becomes a side issue, because we have a society in which we are forcing people into positions where they're not able to maximize or reach their full potential. That's like by design. We don't want people to strive after their full potential. But that fact didn't really come up in this conversation, and I don't think it comes up often enough when we're talking about IQ.
How big is this ship?
There are 24 decks. Almost 700 meters long.
It took me 6 months to scrounge up enough titanium just to build a 4-meter cockpit. How much did this thing cost?
The economics of the future are somewhat different. You see, money doesn't exist in the 24th century.
No money? You mean you don't get paid?
The acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force in our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity.
Arise, ye workers from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. That's right. For reason in revolt now thunder. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Away with all your superstitions. Serve our masses. Arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come on and rally. Then the last fight let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race.
So, yes. So, like, obviously, Ezra Klein and I have radically different politics. In fact, I've put him into the gulag. He's out on parole supervision because of how masterfully he handled Sam Harris. But I don't, you know, I get that, yes, he's I don't need to go into a political description of him right now, but our politics are profoundly different. And I also think that as a sidebar, I think one of the kind of most disingenuous and actually really disgusting ironies and hypocrisies is that one of the moves that Murray and Harris and actually Peterson make, I guess, when they touch on this stuff is sort of like, well, hey, being intelligent isn't the be all end all of life. And, you know, even if somebody's less, cognitively complex, they should be treated with respect and dignity. And Harris is a little more squirrely on this stuff, but certainly Murray's whole political project is to, you know, terrorize and harm through policy people whom he deems to be cognitively complex. So, you know, my view is like, yes, I don't think that, and I'm stipulating, like, again, I am enormously wary of IQ as a metric. But I'll get back to the broader point in a second, but I think, or maybe this is actually really the broader point. I think that in a whole range of things, from housing to healthcare to vacations to just opportunities to explore the full range of your humanity free from being, forced into threadbare private contracts, I don't think that any type of exceptional human performance is required of that. Like, I don't think you need to be a great scholar or a great athlete or, funny or whatever, or any of the other things that we sort of fetishize in the society to have a good life. And I think it's shockingly disingenuous for those people to sort of kind of fall back on that point when, they don't support things like single payer healthcare, right? Like, it actually makes it sort of doubly disgusting, because in a way you could say, and it was weird, Ezra Klein actually kind of went there for a minute in the interview. Like, hey, if we're really finding out that all this stuff is just luck of the draw, doesn't that mean that we really should just have a total sort of universal safety net society because, you're just, born this way, to Lady Gaga or whatever, which is a totally, and I think, again, I think it's a very toxic way of getting to that point. But if they were at least sincere about, and I don't think they are, but if they were for a second sincere about this stuff being, in the genes or from God or whatever, then it would seem to me that the only ethical answer would be that, everybody's taken care of. But I think that the second The second point, though, is that while, and this kind of gets back to my first concern, so I agree that Ezra Klein, obviously, although he kind of had his moment there, but, you know, overall in his mass structure of society is not putting capital and the structure into play. Because, you know, even somebody like Adolf Reed, when he wrote his original critique of the bell curve, you know, he was just like, I mean, obviously this is, you know, this is just sort of racism with numbers. And also that this fits into, you know, the ascriptive identity of black people and structural white supremacy in this country is inseparable from the economic, you know, cycles of America. So that this is also very much a class issue. And I think that IQ also tracks with, you know, it seems to me with class, it seems to me so obvious that this is an outcome of oppression and not a precondition to oppression. It seems just kind of mind-blowingly obvious. But that being said, I do think though that if somebody was to take the Klein perspective, like if some person listened to that debate and they were genuinely sort of, you know, I like Vox and I like Sam, and they're sort of in that very kind of quanti kind of like, I just want to know the facts kind of nerdy sort of space, which I have a lot of problems with.
Yeah, we should talk about that.
And they,
go ahead.
Yeah, we can get to that. But if they think Harris won that debate, then there's no hope for them having critical awareness about anything. If they think Klein won that debate, then at least the pathway of understanding, like, well, wait a second, something like racism is a historical and contingent, you know, phenomenon that works on so many levels, and it's such a driving force that we can't distinguish it from things like quote unquote science. Well, I don't think that that's the be all end all, but I do think that that's a potential doorway into having a critique that includes racism and white supremacy, but also gets the economic structure, gets the class functionality, because you're at least on the road to, not just looking at what's in front of you and confirming your comforts and biases, but actually thinking structurally. If you took the Harris road, you know, then you're done. Because if you can't even do basic good human liberalism about, you know, like, let's face it, a profoundly racist and violent country in history and contemporary reality, then how are you going to crack open capital? I just don't see it.
Right. Okay. So this is where, you and I might have a slight disagreement, or maybe a profound disagreement. I'm not sure, but it comes down to like the power of the nerd here, because, you know, if you're truly a nerd, then your first question isn't going to be who won the debate, because the nerdy question is who was right, and that's not the same thing as who won the debate, and when were they right. You know, and so you like, you get real abstract at that point. And that's at least what I try to,
So who
approach.
Won the debate?
I don't know. that's for people who are, you know, neurotypical to decide. But that comes down to, it does come down to, rhetoric and, social position and a lot of things that are not strictly determined by what's right logically or through reason. And I think that who won the debate depends on that level, just like in a political debate, between, say, two candidates running for office. It comes down to what party you're in as to who you say won that debate, and what your starting assumptions are, and what kind of person you find to be more attractive. All of that is going to color who you think won the debate. And like, so when you're a candidate, what your job is when you're in a debate is to be, this is why someone like Hillary Clinton ends up being so stilted, is to be everyone to everybody and to come across in such a way that people can read into you some version of themselves that they want to identify with, you know, so it's more about that.
Well, that's funny though, because then that seems to me like,
Well, then Klein wouldn't debate for most human beings, okay?
Right. No, I mean, I think that's true, but then that, to me, that seems like you're already kind of, you're threading in. I guess if I was to split the difference, I would say that, I mean, you just kind of explained why, you know, there's no such thing as some type of, again, this sort of platonic, non-subjective realm. But I would say even outside of that, I think this is why the preconditions really matter. So, and what I mean by the preconditions is that, especially in a debate like this, because Ezra Klein's actually making a different argument. Ezra Klein's argument is that, yes, at the end of the day, you can't separate this from history and policy, which to me is, I find that to be as close to an objective statement as possible, because I just don't know of any field of human endeavor. Again, I mean, even taking race out of it, like, can you write like a proper exhaustive history of like airplane travel and the airline industry in the United States without looking at, you know, military contractors? And by the way, maybe even like in a positive way, but I'm just saying, like, is it possible to just say, hey, this industry just, you know, to the Wright brothers, and then it just popped up, and then the science happened, and then that was it?
No, right.
You know, if you wanted to write like an exhaustive history, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Not if you just, I mean, again, so I think that that is actually like, so Ezra, and then Ezra's actually saying, not that it's just that, he's actually calling for a kind of integrative perspective. Like, you know, it's the genetics and the science are worth exploring. You need to look at it in a political and policy context. And all Sam is saying is, you know, just hitting the same fundamentalist beat again and again and again. And it strikes me that, yes, if you set the precondition, which is that the only thing that not matters are a couple of numbers in isolation, and then appeals to authority, then he won that.
Oh, well, yeah.
But I do think that there is, it's funny, I actually think that there's some objectivity to saying the idea that you could go to an area this explosive and with so much history and so much policy ramifications and talk about it in isolation. Like, that to me is actually like the fantastical argument and very reflective of a personal, emotional subjectivity, Harris's.
Well, I'm just saying that before you even determine whether or not someone won a debate like that, you have to figure out first, like, what were they debating? And I would feel like, you know, to a large extent, that even that question is not one that everyone would answer the same way. My perspective was they were debating which bias is more consequential when it comes to looking at scientific research around IQ and genetic ancestry. That was what they were fundamentally arguing about, but they didn't address it directly. The only one who Harris wanted to talk about the bias on the political correctness side, Klein wanted to talk about the bias on the side of people like Charles Murray and the racists, but neither of them wanted to accept the other one's terms at all. Like, neither of them would say that the other one had a point or that what they were saying was relevant. And of course, it absolutely is the case that it is relevant that we have this history of racism and the race science is a real thing, and we have to take that into account. But it also, unfortunately, is true that in academic circles, sometimes political correctness does influence the kinds of results that are allowed to be seen. And that, you know, also has to be taken into account. And it's probably not the right thing to even debate if you want to get to the truth of what to do with the information once we get it, whatever it might be, you know, like, what is the right interpretive framework to address questions of ability in a better society. And so the reason I want to go back to the being a nerd and why being a nerd is helpful, and maybe, I mean, I'm hesitant on being too firm on this, but I feel like if you get to a point where you're saying, I'm most interested in what is most true, and I know what my own aims are, I know them, and then I can also question them because I know them. That's a very nerdy philosophical, you know, it's like the philosophy nerd position.
I guess I know. I think it's funny because I've encountered an incredibly small handful of people in my life, of which I actually think you are in some ways, and I actually really admire and like, although it still sometimes frustrates me.
Yeah.
But who are really, but I would say like they're really like, there's a genuineness to like everything is on the table. So as an example, like, and again, I just have to keep reiterating, and I've gone back to this, and there's actually this Ned Block book from the 70s called The IQ Controversy, which to me is so, I mean, and I know it's like the response is going to be like the test has gotten so much better and blah, blah, blah. But to me, it just so lays out it, the politics of it have not changed. And I basically think it's a bullshit metric, but you know, I want to have a much more basic conversation about it. But let me just say
that's my starting point too. By the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I figure it would be. Actually, I'd like to hear more about your thoughts about that. But to me, like, so, like a genuinely, like, radically open sort of position, but just that kind of like I don't know. That would mean like at that time when Harris made the point, and that was, you know, it was very comedic, of course, because. You know, he said, I had just talked with Richard Lynn himself, and it's possible that the 10-point differential could be that actually black people start with like a 2-point over white IQ, but yeah. The difference is 12% of it. And I have to be honest with you, like, this is the type of thing where I'm just like, oh, you know, my eyes are so in the back of my head on so many levels that I just don't think things work like this. But that being said, and Harris was like, no, like that's mischaracterizing his position. And everybody had a good laugh because Klein was like, well, I literally, like,
I just talked to him.
Sam Harris is the type of guy that, like, in Annie Hall, Marshall McLuhan would walk out and say, that's not what I said. And then Harris would argue with him, right? Like, right. There is, like the kind of, like, funny part of his, you know, kind of weird, uptight egomania. But that being said, like, a real nerd, in the positive sense, to be like, oh, that's totally true. And that's fascinating. And maybe because we don't know. So maybe it's right. It could totally be that there's higher black cognition. Let's look at that.
Right.
Or it could be that, you know, there's higher white. And maybe it's because they started eating, you know, shellfish earlier. You know, there is this certain kind of like very, I find though that first of all, almost everybody in the landscape that claims that is not that, right? Like, so Harris has, I think, you know, a political and personal ego agenda, which he totally cannot see.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's harnessing a very, very, very rare frame of mind, which I just think is, as I say, I think honestly, you might be the closest to it actually being I mean, I really do. I think that, like, that real, like, I might have had one or two science professors like this where they really were just curious in the wonders of the world. And, like, you know, nothing upset them. They could entertain the most, you know, anarcho-communist egalitarian idea. They could entertain, but they also didn't get freaked out by creationism either. Like, right. And it wasn't to say they were relativists, but I mean, they really were. You know, in a state of not knowing. And that is not what is represented at all by these people that are claiming it. So I think that.
I know that I know nothing. This Socrates quote causes some discomfort. How can it be good to recognize ignorance of things? Isn't it a problem to say that I know nothing? Especially coming from a philosopher, isn't it disturbing to admit such ignorance? Our conversation today is not merely philosophical. It has a direct impact in our lives and on various issues in society. Ignorance and false beliefs. Our biggest problem is not ignorance, lack of knowledge, or doubts. The problem is our false beliefs.
The trial is over. Here's your hemlock.
Ah, thank you.
Well, what was the verdict? When do I get out of here?
But Socrates, the verdict was death.
Death? You gotta be kidding me. For what?
For teaching the youth wisdom.
Well, I'll take it all back. Call him in here. I'll renounce everything. Let's get out of here. Let's go get some Chinese food.
But Socrates, you drank the hemlock.
For what?
It's poisonous.
It is? Since when?
Didn't you know hemlock is poisonous?
I do now.
Look, I only know general things. What is truth? What is justice? I never learned details. I don't know what is poisonous and what is not poisonous.
This is the kind of thing that irritates me about you guys.
All right. I'm going to lay here, and I'm going to die. And you know what's going to happen? You guys are going to go out, and you'll have dinner, and you'll sit and stare at each other.
I was the only one who ever talked in this whole group.
It was always Socrates, what is truth? Socrates, what is the nature of the good? Socrates, what should I order? Socrates, what are you having?
And not once did anyone ever say, Socrates, hemlock is poison.
Well, see, my being in that state is politically motivated. You see, I mean, like, you know, like, I want people to be in that state, not because I think that it's the most beautiful state to be in or even the most comfortable state to be in for everyone's life all the time, but just because I had an experience of realizing that the ideology that I held wasn't adequate for reality and that I had to – that I didn't understand the world well enough to understand what was going on. And it all was around the financial crisis of 2008. Which I felt as a personal threat given my position at the time. What I ended up doing was trying to figure out what was happening and realizing I had to abandon a lot of ideas along the way. Also, I admire Descartes and, you know, and that whole, his meditations and trying to doubt everything and love like Philip K. Dick's paranoia and not knowing what the real is and all of that. So, like, it's not even so my nerdy position is not one where it isn't also incredibly subjective and like set up by my own personal experience. It really is. And I know that it's not it's certainly not where everyone's at, but I do think it's politically useful, especially when all the ways that we've tried to deal with political problems or social or economic problems haven't been working and we end up seeing repetitions. And, you know, and the same sort of cycle.
But don't you, I'm sorry, but I guess, but don't you think, so I'm not saying that, yeah, I mean, there's tons of, you know, there's tons of repetitions and problems in some of the, you know, in some of the politics that Ezra Klein would fall into, right? Which is, I would say, essentially, and, you know, he's changing with the zeitgeist like everybody else. So now he's more amenable to at least some kind of social democratic positions. But basically, like a corporate-friendly, quantitative-driven neoliberal who wants to see, greater racial and gender equity. And as I always say, if our only two choices are like, white nationalist capitalism or diversity capitalism, I pick diversity capitalism. I just hope that those aren't right. Every time I just hope those aren't our, you know, two choices. But I do think that first position in the argument, and I actually would in my own nerdy sense, I actually really am. It's funny. I'm going to really lean into this is true. You cannot discuss whether it be foreign policy or race or class IQ gap without it does not need to be reducible to this at all times, but you cannot have a conversation that is serious and deals with those things without full, ongoing, and in every part included political, economic, and social analysis. And by the way, again, you know, maybe it's right wing, right? Like maybe it's a different, you know, I'm not even saying it has to be from a particular angle, but right. So I think though that is where the stakes were high, because I think Ezra, even though it was in a limited way, it's representing at least going down the path of we've actually got to think about contingencies here. Whereas Sam's view is, it's not just that the world is as it is. It's that any questioning of that is fundamentally subjective and illegitimate. And that is antithetical to any critical theory and political project.
He falls into what's called scientism. He's not very scientific when he wants to claim that the scientific consensus on this is settled and that anyone who would doubt it is just politically motivated. I mean, that's just hogwash. It's ridiculous. And I'm with you when it comes to this idea that you can't even try to determine what someone's genetic, what the genetic factors are in determining, say, intelligence, if you haven't looked at the material basis really deeply. In other words, if you just say, well, we're going to look at black people and white people and when they have the same income. And therefore, you know, well, yeah, that's not adequate at all, because white people who have middle-class income are living in neighborhoods which have historically developed so much more wealth and resources that they don't have the same material
and are less likely to have to support extended families. And if we look at the epigenetics research, you know, we know that, you know, that there's, you know, memories literally physically carried over from historical traumas. And by the way, let me just make this addendum point, because I love what you just said about that too. This goes for, you know, I haven't dug enough into this poll, but there's this new poll that the sort of identity side of the debate, you know, the kind of anti-Bernie people love, because it's like, you know, basically the top line was that some kind of white voters that flipped to Trump were more concerned about losing standing than economic insecurity, and that they're actually really economically well off. Now, and again, I'm not somebody who, you know, I don't deny that racism and sexism and all the rest are very much in operation. And I'm sure there were some people that were like, all right, we had a black guy, and now a chick, you know, it's enough. I have no doubt. I think it'd be delusional to deny that. But even that, it's like, well, wait a second. Standing could be, you know, I still have to support my kid, and now I'm coming to the full realization that they're never going to make as much money as me. You know, like there could be a much broader sense in which that term is understood to mean a broader decline in what people consider to be an American experience. And so, you know what I mean? So it's even on that identity side, it can be very reductive. Like, you know, it's like, no, what's the bigger context of that question? What does it really mean?
Right. I mean, standing is a marker of economic security, too.
Well, this is what they say, though, because those were the people that were the most, like, their incomes had not declined. Their economic standing on paper was good. But the point I'm making is, if that doesn't take into account how they might perceive and connect their economics beyond just their own little atomized unit, they might be thinking about their uncle that lost the job, their kid that can't get ahead. And they might connect that with standing. America has less standing. There's less opportunity. There's less, like, those are more interesting questions. But the people who just want to do the it's all racism, the economics don't matter, they love that isolated stat. And my point is that even on a terrain that I disagree with, but obviously am not, you know, like I'm less politically offended by or whatever, you still see the problem with that sort of mode of analysis. It's just like, yeah, like, what does standing mean? Can you really even separate standing from economic security? And they say, like, well, we did because we have these stats. But I want to know about extended families. I want to know how people's view of standing is connected with their broader understanding of the economy and U.S. competitiveness. Like, that's what I want to know before I take that at face value.
Right. I mean, the reason why, if you're a screenwriter, you're not just satisfied with being given a big paycheck for your work, but you also want your name on the marquee or in the credits is because you want the standing, because that will help you secure future work, right?
I mean, right, yeah. Right. Yes.
So,
yes, exactly.
But yeah, so I agree with you. But so look, my main point here, the reason I want to talk to you about this, and I think this has been a really good conversation, is that I still think that when we side with someone like Klein in a debate with Harris, and which we ought to do, that we shouldn't close off being critical of Klein even during the debate. And like, I think that it's important to point out that we don't live in a society where equality of outcome would be possible, or and that we don't even have a good idea of what equality of outcome we really are after. But that because we live in a class society, a lot of these questions around merit are just the wrong questions to be asking, and we never should accept Murray's framing of these issues. I mean, and specifically now, because like now he's moved on from race, and he's really trying to justify the class system to working class whites specifically. I mean, his recent book was about how the cognitive elite are, you know, creating a culture of difference that and destroying American values and all that kind of nonsense. And all of it is basically designed to say, hey, you can be stuck in a shitty job and not have real economic security, but people should still treat you with respect. And that should be enough.
Right.
And
well, I think that's a misreading also. Like the bell curve in my is a racist book, but I read the chapters of Concern. But the core argument of the bell curve is economic, like inequality justification, not racism. So it's a misframe even of that book.
Right. Yeah. And so we need to like stay on target with these assholes and not let them reframe our politics for us is what I would say. And the way to do it is maybe, I'm not sure, but I think it's to be nerdy and a little detached some of the time or disinterested.
I think what an example on the positive end that I think Walter Ben Michaels uses, I'm pretty sure he uses it, but so this is a good example of where I'm coming from. And this is where I think it's like, you know what it is? I think these conversations are pre and post. Like, you know, we have this resurgence of people like Harris that are, you know, basically
like
they
Murray.
Just want to
resurgence of Murray.
Well, I think Harris, yeah, I mean, Harris is facilitating Murray. So Harris, Murray, all of this. At the end of the day, it's justification and reinforcement of economic, racial, and gender hierarchy. And whether they know it or not, that's what they're doing. And so anytime they, you know, they don't want to hear about identity because they don't want to know anything, right? And then we have the politics that I think, you know, you and I are familiar with, where it's like the sum total of politics is simply recognizing identity categories. And that's not going to get us out of capitalism. That's not going to, it might be, you know, it's necessary. It's important relative to the Murrays of the world, but it's not going to get us out of the out of some of these predicaments we're in. So the positive example of that would be like Ta-Nehisi Coates, right? And it's funny because I've criticized him a lot, but I have to say this whole debacle has reminded me of why I think in some ways he has a very positive role in culture. He wrote, you know, very well, just historically and narrative-wise on the history of redlining and racial discrimination and housing, and connected that again with the type of thing that, you know, the type of stats that, of course, you need to know on intergenerational wealth and racial discrimination in this country, that, you know, set the context for even just like the awareness that you expressed earlier that, like, you know, two families making $200,000 a year, one's white, one's black, that means totally different things. And of course, on a class level, if we're going to take class that way too, I mean, if I, you know, I might have relatives I need to support at some
point.
Right.
It depends on where you live too, right?
Yeah. And it depends on where you live and exactly all of these variables. So on the relative level and where I'm defending Klein in this, I think that yes, if white people, if we were to take that one particular slice of division, if white people read Ta-Nehisi Coates' history of redlining and racial discrimination and wealth transfer and systemic racism, we would be a better, you know, white people, frankly, would just be better. And there might be less room for some asshole like Sam Harris to say that that stuff, you know, is irrelevant to the science. But where the missing link is, and where I totally agree with you, is that the policy answer, and again, this is, you know, on a relative level, okay, if you're going to have the society we have, then we need to, you know, ban discrimination, sue banks, sue landlords, have legal and policy redress. But the ultimate answer is like, you know, you look at those pages and it's like, well, you know, two families, they have the same credit, the same income, and one's racially discriminated against. My ultimate answer is like, you shouldn't have to have an income and a credit to have a great house. We need to decommodify housing for everybody because it's totally fucked up and it's seen in its own way that you need to be at a certain category to live in a good place with, you know, your family or by yourself or whatever. And so that's ultimately the solution. But I do maintain that Klein and Coates at least point in the direction of that awareness, where if we're stuck on the Harris level, we're not going to get anywhere.
Right. Well, I mean, the true problem with Harris is he's nothing like what he claims to be. I mean, you know, he says he wants to be. This is like the thing that I sometimes like the guys on Chapo, I think they even like have a shirt or something about it. And to being against logic or something like that. And
against logic, facts, and reason, right?
Right. It's funny, but on the other hand, I was like, oh, but you're just ceding so much territory. And you're not really, but I mean, I get it. No, but it just seems like the problem is not the only way you can get that joke is to understand that the people who claim logic, facts, and reason have no use for any of that. Right. And that, you know, the people who are the big free speech advocates right now don't give a damn about free speech and certainly don't give a damn about, free thought and the development of thought. You know, so we always need to keep that in mind. It's like Harris isn't what he claims to be, but part of his popularity is that people want that. They want to figure out. How to step back from the roles that they're kind of caught in and make their own way in the world. And the way, and doing that through a somewhat disinterested stance and taking things in and making judgments through reason rather than emotional reaction. That's part of the process of kind of breaking free and developing your own identity and politics, I think.
Do you think that they, I guess my question is, and this is, you know, and this is another problem with the sampling, but I always, you know, I wish I could remember when I first read this study, I did not have the same all-consuming skepticism of these types of studies that I do now, but it was fascinating. And they basically, some psychologists, social psychologists or something back in the 60s, they did they basically were interviewing college students that were resisting the Vietnam War and dodging the draft. Now, I just want to stipulate, I don't think you need to have a good reason to dodge the draft. Like, I think, you know, not wanting to get killed or kill people in Vietnam is good enough, right? But what was interesting, and, you know, nobody needs to be a fucking hero, but what was interesting was that they sort of like, you know, everybody they talked to, you know, they talked about U.S. imperialism and all the Vietnamese, you know, people that were being murdered by our weapons and, you know, the just grotesque immorality of the U.S. war in Vietnam. And then they, you know, whatever method they used, they basically came to the conclusion that about 20-30% of these people were truly like, they had some type of kind of global metacognition and they really were like, in a state of pure moral conviction, even to the point that they were willing to risk themselves physically, kind of like on the other end of the equation, like go to jail or right. It might have been lower. You know what? Maybe let's say it was lower. The point was that exactly, you know, and everybody else just didn't want to fucking go to Vietnam. Now in this case, right? Now in this case, I mean, I no judgment at all, and I have no idea how I'd score on that test. But I think though that, and what is the number in the kind of all of these different online cults and in the Harris cult, what is the number of the people who really want that versus the people who want, you know, soothing meditative racism and, you know, bad foreign policy to confirm all of their, you know, prejudices and instincts?
Well, I don't know. I think there's a middle ground. I mean, I think that wanting to have their own sense of what, who they like to be reflected back to them is.
Well, that's fair. Everybody wants that.
Yeah. And that's, I think that, and then who they want to be includes, you know, maybe I'm this disinterested smart guy who can, you know, my son's a math major. You know, I kind of have run into these kids that are hyper nerdy and pride themselves in thinking things through and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, but there's always limits to that. There's always limits to how truly disinterested you can be. And I think it's probably mostly very shallow, you know, even amongst the audience. But the challenge, I just want to always challenge them and say, okay, let's do that. Let's see where we go if we do that. Because I'm convinced that they'll end up reading Capital Volume 1.
So, how does that end up happening?
Because it's the best book. Because my state. Well.
Because it's the best book. And Marx wrote the best book. And everybody says so. And it's true.